Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we have got a topic today that I think is an extremely important one. I was out doing errands this morning, and I was listening to a broadcast about a teenage girl who was really badly abused by bullies in the school that she was in. And this was a private school. This wasn't a public school. And finally, there had to be some legal action taken. It was an incredible story to listen to. And then I was talking to someone not that long ago on the show. We were talking about cyberbullying. Well, my guest today, Joe Wojcik, is a man that knows all about this firsthand. He was given a nickname of Yubby when he was a little boy. But we're going to find out more about this man and the books that he's published and what he's involved with to deal with this issue of bullying. Joe, welcome to the show.
Donna, thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, I really was so impressed with you when I met you at the National Publicity Summit. And when you told me that you had material on bullying, we have had in the Pacific Northwest so much of this hitting the news media big time, and it's been something that I think every generation has had to cope with. But Joe, I wanted people to know a little bit about you. You really are involved with kids. This is something...
I am. I do presentations throughout the New England and throughout the United States in schools, from kindergarten to third grade, fourth to sixth grade, seventh, eighth grade, and high schools, as Joe the Biker. I use this very interesting persona as a way of capturing their attention, trying to convey a very serious message about bullying, and giving children the tools to help them cope with it. This year, I will have been in front of 60,000 students.
Wow, Joe, that's amazing. Now, you have developed a partnership with the Massachusetts Foster Care Unit because you're developing educational programs. You have served on the board of MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and you have developed the Say No to Bullying programs that you have presented before 60,000 students throughout the country. You're really into motorcycles, martial arts. You live in Massachusetts. Joe, your story really touched my heart when I was reading about you because you were one of these kids that was a chubby checker?
I was, to say the least. I was an overweight child, and I was targeted very early in life, around fourth grade, by bullies in my school.
Now, we hear about these things, and there are people, and I can remember being bullied when I was growing up by a neighborhood kid. This is something, as I said a moment ago, every generation has to deal with. When you were growing up and this was occurring with you, you kept it pretty much to yourself, didn't you? You didn't share it very much with your family.
Well, actually, my brothers were part of the bullies. So it was not only experiencing it at school, but because I was very different, my brothers were kind of two of the bullies that picked on me and were very mean to me during the course of my childhood. So I did tell my mother at one time, and unfortunately she had an improper response to me wanting to take my life at 11 years old, as far as having three occasions of even thinking of taking my life. And she reacted to it in such a negative way, I never said anything more about it.
What did she say to you?
Well, my mother was a very religious person, and so when I told her one day when I came home crying, just having experienced some very torturous events, and I told her I wanted to die, she made me kneel and pray that God didn't strike me dead and told me to go to my room.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had issues too. So in my first book, I kind of tell, it's like a memoir and explains my life experience. My mother had issues that she was dealing with. So she was not necessarily the best nurturing parent to have when a child is experiencing these emotional conflicts in their life.
Well, and you have to think of her time frame too. You have to think of your father, the whole environment that you came up through, and the environment of those that were around you. Now, for parents that are listening to us today, you were nicknamed Yubby. You have written a book, Call Me Yubby, also Yubby, The Rise and Fall of an Everyday Joe, and there's a picture of you in your scouting uniform. But you had really, and you also have a workbook, you put so much of yourself in, because this is your story, obviously, but you don't seem to hold anything back regarding this. How long did it take you to reach that point where you had this openness about what happened to you when you were a kid?
Well, it actually happened when I had an accident at 30 years old. I was involved in a very serious car accident, and it left me to convalesce for some 17 years. I had lost the use of my left arm. It took me 5 years to get that back. And in the process of convalescing, I started to meditate. And it was in my meditations that it started appearing to me events that happened in my childhood that came to recall and had explained to me why up to about age 30 years old, and that's what people don't understand sometimes, is that, you know, we go through these experiences as a child. And everybody says, well, you know, tomorrow's another day. You'll grow up at a given point in time. Well, for the children that are bullied, that can walk away with it because they feel good about themselves, they have maybe a healthy self-confidence, and they can walk away. Others, like myself, internalize it. And those that mm-hmm. internalize it eventually get involved with other problems. And it led me into substance abuse in my teens, eventually into my college life, and always having a chip on my shoulder towards other people. I had lost all my weight when I turned 19 years old, and eventually a very destructive lifestyle until my accident, which made me understand what had defined me as a man actually had happened to me when I was a boy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You had a wonderful mentor, that's what I will call him, and he was the father of a friend named Danny. And I was so impressed with the way that this man conducted himself. Tell us about Danny's dad.
Well, the book that you're referring to is Call Me Yubby, and yes, that book is a fiction book. So it is not the story itself, which is in a journal entry form, talks about meeting this mentor. Well, that mentor is me as an adult.
That's
so
okay.
There was no Danny and no mentor. Unfortunately, I didn't have a mentor when I was young. But all these experiences that I had since I was 30 years old that helped me understand how to love myself, to take care of myself, to build my self-confidence and self-esteem, I now was sharing with me when I was a child.
Your dad was pretty intense when it came to disciplining your kids. What kind of a man was your father?
I always loved my father and respected him very highly. He came from an old school. He came from a childhood where, in his life, he was the youngest one, and he was brutalized when he was a child. So what happens with so many parents, they become parents the same way they were taught to be parents by theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty rigid. I was always afraid of him, and that's very important. Children shouldn't be afraid of their parents. I would never tell my dad because I know he would not even care or listen, so I believed, back when I was a child. He was a very brilliant man. Unfortunately, he was similar to how his father was, and his father was very structured and very disciplined as far as the old Polish way of disciplining.
The background of an individual really makes a difference, and I had a very dear friend, his name was Steve, and he was a very, very well-known radio broadcaster, and I had the privilege of working with him for a number of years before he passed away. And I'll never forget his mother telling me how if he had come from a different environment, he probably would have been a sports star, because not only was he extremely intelligent, but his gifts in sports, natural physical gifts for sports, was just absolutely incredible. But she said his father was Yugoslavian, and his father was very, very brutal with him and very, very harsh. I think he had four or five brothers, and all of them were treated with the same kind of harshness. And she said it had such an impact on him that, as brilliant as he was, he always put himself into a deferring positioning. And I want to ask you a question, Joe. What do you think the difference is in the effects of bullying with girls versus boys, or is there really a difference?
Well, I think bullying has the same nature, no matter if it's a boy or a girl. Boys tend to be more physical around bullying. Girls seem to be more covert. That's why with the advent of cyberbullying, now it's more a covert way of bullying that we see a higher rise as far as girls being bullied, because they have a new tool, a new media to use. So basically, the bullying is always about humiliating, embarrassing, harassing someone, making fun of them. And girls do it a little bit differently than boys. They do it more behind the scenes, where boys will tend to do it right in front of you.
I think that has a lot to do with gang activity as well. It's been my observation that frequently that patterning evolves, and boys have a tendency, and the girls too. I've seen girls do this, but the boys will get together in groups, and this is perpetuated in a phenomenal way in the hierarchy of its structure. Have you ever done any work with gangs?
I haven't really worked with gangs. I understand well the mindset. You really think about it. When we were young, all we ever wanted to do is belong. And that's so critical for parents to know, because their children, just like Yubby, he wanted just to be part of something. And if you don't get the structure at home, if you don't have the nurturing atmosphere of a family, if you don't have the continuous support of your parents participating in your life, being active in your life, you look somewhere else. And it is our nature as human beings. Our ancestors always joined small communities, 7, 8. And you see the exact same thing happening in schools where there's 7, 8 boys getting together, or girls. There's usually a leader. There's a couple secondary steps. And it's our basic human need to have this sense of community with a smaller group. And either you're in the group or you're on the outside of the group. So that's why when we go into schools, we really want to try to expand that community, expand it to, it's not just about 7 people, it's about your whole school being a community. And your job in that community is to respect and protect each of its members. So trying to change the actual culture of a school, thinking that everybody belongs, it doesn't matter how different you look. I am different looking today, as you know, Donna, when you first met me. Even to this day, people don't accept me. Because when I dress up as Joe the Biker in my leathers, and I'm a pretty big guy, I'm a weightlifter, I got tattoos, they look at me and they see that I'm different. Sometimes they even get out of my way because they're afraid of me. They totally misunderstand me today as they misunderstood me when I was Yubby. And that's why we try to empower students. We try to empower them to believe it's okay to be just like you are, and everybody belongs in that community of your school. So it's your obligation, if you see somebody else picking on someone, to intervene, tell an adult to do something, because everybody belongs.
Yes, they do. And I think of what I mentioned right at the beginning of the show, of the broadcast that I heard about this young girl being bullied in such a way in her school, and she went to one of the teachers, and the teacher said, well, the culture of this school is they pick one student, and that student is the one that they're going to bully. Suck it up, basically, was the teacher's attitude, and just let it be. Well, this girl ended up suffering some very severe injuries that made it so she could never dance again. They kicked her in the back and this type of thing. You hear these stories, and they are just appalling, absolutely appalling. Now, I know
you do, and it's because not all, but there are those teachers and administrators in schools, and I, as I said, I go through a lot of schools. It's really thinking about bullying that is important. Some think, like you've just mentioned, that it's like a passageway in order to become an adult. You're going to experience these things in life, so like you said, suck it up and walk forward and don't let it bother you. Well, what they're now finding out through research is some people can't suck it up when they're young because they're still in the stage of emotional development. And there has never been any research that has indicated bullying of any kind developed character. None. It all is destructive. And the saddest part about it all is that a student, if they internalize it, like Yubby did and I did, it can lead to a lot of, as you mentioned even in that other story, behaviors in, as adults that we have to cope with. You know, interesting, so many times I've mentioned to the people that I thought of taking my life when I was 11 years old. There's no erasers in my head. There are no delete buttons. When times get very stressful in my life and I'm really challenged, sometimes I literally default back to those earlier experiences. And that takes me away from being successful. Now, today I cope with it. I say, Joe, you know better. You know where it came from. But I still have to cope with it. That's the critical thing. That's why we need to work on bullying in the schools, because we don't want any student to internalize it. We don't want to have any students scarred with this low self-esteem, because they don't become a very productive individual in life, because they're always having to cope with the underlying childhood experiences that they have.
Joe, let me ask you a question. Let's say a child comes home, like when you tried to talk to your mom and your mom reacted the way she did. A parent that might be listening to the show today would say, you know, my son or my daughter, they don't really want to talk to me about things that are going on in school. And kids, as they're growing up, they have to do things their own way. What do you think parents need to be alert to and aware of? There's so many families, both parents are working, their time with their kids is somewhat limited. How can a parent become alert and aware to things? And what would you recommend to develop a good communication rapport with the kid?
Well, you hit it right on the head. I got to tell you, Donna, the reality is this. Parents that have children need to spend time with them. And even on my, as you know, I started a foundation where I raise funds to put my program into schools. And on that website, I literally have a weekly dinner topic. I encourage parents to take the time to and spend it with their children. They took on a responsibility when they had the children to make them an important part of their life. So what we find is parents that are involved with their children, be it in sports, having dinner together. And matter of fact, quite frankly, research has proven families that have dinner together have significantly reduced chances of developmental problems in their children because they have that sense of community. So the greatest recommendation I can give to parents from the day that that child is born is to make them an integral part of their life, spending time with them. And the reason for that is, if you're daily sitting with your child trying to get exact feedback of what's happening in their life, and all of a sudden one day they don't sound right, they don't sound up to beat, they're a little bit withdrawn, those are beginning signs that something's happening in that child's life that you should now pursue and try to get more information about. And that's why parents that spend time with their children are far more capable of detecting the early warning signs that their child's bullying, being bullied. Now, obviously, there's signs like they come home with ripped clothing, they lose books, they have damaged toys that they have brought to school. Maybe they take a different way of walking home from school because they're afraid of walking home in the old direction. These are signs that are very obvious. What we want to be is there when the child is having that experience to be able to detect that. And they do. Children are like windows, like mirrors. Whatever they got on their face and their tone detects what's happening in their life. And it's an opportunity for parents at that point to try to encourage more communication. And it has to be subtle. Parents have to be open. Parents have to make their children feel good about themselves. The more self-confident a child is, the more apt they're to tell their parents what's happening rather than trying to solve the problem by themselves. So my biggest advice to parents is spend time with your children. Make your children feel good and healthy. And that's critical. Good, healthy self-confidence. And as I tell all the students through all the schools, it's not you who has the problem. It's the bully who has the problem. So parents, when they find out that their child's being bullied, need to say, you're okay just the way you are. You were made perfect. It's not you who has a problem. It's this child who maybe has issues at home, who comes to school every day, and they are mean to others because of things that are happening in their life. So you can see where all this nurturing builds up that confidence in that child, makes them feel good about themselves. So they're more apt to open up conversation and communication with you. And with that exchange, you get more details. Now what you do is you take steps. And obviously contacting the school is the first step.
What would you say to a kid? You have kids. You've been in front of 60,000 children. You have, I'm sure, some wonderful stories to share, but some kids are really small. They don't know how to defend themselves. Bullies, again, I've never known a generation that hasn't experienced them.
Right.
What would you say to young people today? There might be someone that's got a kid that they know that's got a problem that's listening today. What would you say to a youngster that maybe would come up to you and say, hey, Big Joe, I got a problem? And he'd talk to you, he or she, say, I just don't know what to do. What
Donna,
would you tell them to do?
I have that happen to me when I do my performances. And offhand, I think of two where after my presentation, I try to empower students to feel good about themselves, that they were made perfect, they have a right to be in that school, and they have a right to be safe. And so what they have to do is find the courage, the fortitude, to stand up and stand up for their rights and tell an adult. I've had in two very specific situations, right after a performance, pull on my coat, say, can I say something to you? And tell me of what happened the previous day in a boys' locker room. And I turn around and I call the principal over and say, we have to have a chat right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really about empowering students, and that's what Joe the Biker does. Because they look at him now, he's this big, strong, tough guy. They can't even imagine how I've ever been bullied. And when I tell them I used to sit on my bed and I cried, when I talk to the older students and I tell them about standing on a floodgate, thinking about jumping off and ending my life because I could not stop the relentless bullying, I empower these students so much that even lately in a junior high, I had a student announce that he was coming out right in front of all his classmates. And I was told afterwards by a counselor he had been so troubled over the last year because of harassment. And he was so afraid because he had a different sexual preference that he was afraid to tell people and he was afraid to do anything about it. Here's a kid who now, after hearing this biker, says, you know what? I'm proud who I am. I am proud. And that's what I try to do. And that's why what we have to do to children is to make them feel they're okay just the way they are. They have a right. They have to stand up for those rights in the school. And the way to do that is to tell an adult so we adults can help them be safe.
I agree. When families and or children encounter people that don't even want to believe them, what would you say to that kid? What would you say to them that would be the step that they would need to do? Because that happens. You had it happen with your mother.
And I say this both for the children and the parents. Because many times parents call the school up and the school even denies it. I tell kids, keep a journal. You got a note back? Sure, they all have notepads. All right, in your notepad, do you write down the date, who was around when it happened, where did it happen, and you just keep on making these notes. Because this is what's going to happen. Even if the school says, oh, no, that didn't happen, or we don't know anything about it, if parents and children keep a log, a journal, what happens at some point in time, you can now walk in front of a school committee, a superintendent, and say, here are the facts, dates, times, people that were around. And so it's like the legal system. When you go to court, if you can present all that information, the jury's going to believe you, because why else would you be keeping all those notes? How could you possibly be that accurate unless it really did happen? And that's what I strongly suggest to both parents and students.
You have adopted foster children through the years, you and your wife, and it has had a tremendous impact on you.
We have had over 100 foster children in a period of 14 years.
That's incredible.
And though we never adopted them, we took care of them mm-hmm. through times that the state of Massachusetts was trying to figure out what to do with them. If they were going to go into more foster care, if they were going to go into a residential setting, or maybe be reunified with their parents. But what I learned the most of, as I write to one who's in a major prison right now in Massachusetts, they taught me that we are all but byproducts of everything that happened to us in life. And all those children that came to us, they were capable of educating me to understand how important their childhood was that eventually led them to where they were when they came to us. We also understood how insensitive parents can be, how inadequate some parents can be into nurturing because of their own problems, per se. And so it was very educational. It was a fantastic experience because it really put the light on childhood nurturing. And at the end of the day, it is all about how parents in their first 7 to 8 years of life nurture a child. They help them dealing with various emotions, and what they determine during those first 7 to 8 years, they will now use as a reference for their entire life. Believe it or not, their entire life. So that's why it's so critical that parents really focus on positive nurturing when children are young to make them strong and healthy. And, of course, the parents have to be strong and healthy, too. Right?
Yes, they do, Joe. You have so much wonderful information in both of your books, Call Me Yubby, and also Yubby, The Rise and Fall of an Everyday Joe. I think that even though Call Me Yubby is written in a fiction format, the other one, The Rise and Fall of an Everyday Joe, isn't. This is about your life. And I think both of the books are loaded with a lot of good information that is empowering to anyone that wants to read it. And I think because today we live in a world where so many young people really do not know what to do with themselves, and we have technology that enables them to do sometimes things that are pretty darn ugly because they can be detached. It's like, no, you can't catch me at this. And I really think the more that we can be educated as adults and also doing what you're doing, being in front of students and educating them and being open with what you went through, I think that's a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment, and I think you're doing a lot of good, Joe, and I think your presence and your delivery is warm. It comes from the heart, just like the materials in your book do, and I think that that is absolutely wonderful. Now, you have a website called Joe the Biker.
www.joethebiker.com, and you mentioned that workbook I have. That workbook is available to parents. And the workbook I have, that's the Say No to Bullying Today workbook for students, helps parents nurture children. It has tremendous activities in it. It makes parents spend time with their children, helping them develop healthy, positive emotional responses to things that can happen in their life. So I think it's an excellent book for parents to use to even educate their children. And I'll think of this near the end of our conversation. In our state, in order to get a driver's license, you have to take a course and a test. If you wanted to get a license to have a firearm in our state, you have to take a course and a test. But parents don't have to be educated to be parents. And think of the responsibility that all parents have in healthily nurturing their children. That's why I came up with a workbook to help parents be able to become even better parents, to help nurture those children so they're healthy and strong, so they can have the shields. So when they are bullied, they know that they can respond, they feel good about themselves, they don't internalize it, and they can go on to be healthy adults.
Well, I think you're doing a great job, Joe, and I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to meet you in New York. I know you will enjoy continued success. For those of you listening, this is a challenge that we face today, and I think JoeTheBiker.com is a website that's worth visiting. So do take your time to do that. Check out his books. They are wonderful. Call Me Yubby, and then Yubby, The Rise and Fall, or The Fall and Rise, excuse me, I reversed it, of an Everyday Joe. Both of them are good books, plus the workbook. You may know somebody that really could use some help. Great information. Joe, thanks so much for being with me today.
Donna, it's been my extreme pleasure to be on your show. And it was also a pleasure of meeting you in New York. You have just such a beautiful energy about you. You're a great person.
Thank you very much, Joe. This is Donna Sebo. Don't forget, call me Yubby, Joe the Biker. Find out more. Go to his website, joethebiker.com. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And telephone number is for you to call in if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. I'd be delighted to do a reading for you on the air. The telephone number to call in to is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I came across an article about a woman that works with cheetahs, and this really was fascinating to me. A few years back, I had the opportunity to do a speaking engagement, and it was in Ohio. and I don't recall the city right now, but it was this wonderful community that was outside in what used to be a very, very large farm area and had been developed into a whole group of homes. And I had a wonderful class that I did out there with a lot of people. Well, the woman who was the hostess that had had me come out to do the program, she said, I want you to meet someone that is a very special person. Her name was Catherine, and this woman worked with cheetahs. And we went to Catherine's home, and to my amazement, there was a cheetah in her family room. I'm not kidding. It was really there. And this cheetah was less than 2 years old. And Catherine proceeded to tell me a wonderful story about this special cheetah that she was taking care of. Catherine seemed to have this magical touch when it came to the big cat. And this cheetah had been in a zoo, had been brought in as a rather young animal, and was not doing well at all. And there was a friend that had contacted her and said, you need to come into the zoo. I believe it was in Arizona, because this animal is dying. We're going to lose this cheetah. Cheetahs apparently are very fragile. They do not fare all that well in zoos, and they require a lot of particular attention. And if you know your history, you realize that cheetahs were often tamed by people of royalty. They would have them in their homes. So they were big cats, but they were used for hunting and for display, if you will. So anyway, Catherine goes down with a friend, and this cheetah, the friend's husband happened to walk by, and this cheetah just identified with the husband. Well, it scared this guy to death. And Catherine said, don't be afraid. Please go into the cage, because the animal's responding to you. The animal was very ill. So she said, just go into the cage. So this man goes into the cage, and the cat just walks up to him and is purring. Well, this is still a wild cat, and she tells him what to do. And so he puts his back up against the wall, slides himself down physically until he's sitting on the floor, and this cheetah comes over and just curls right up next to him, right in his lap, and just bonded with this man. Had never seen this man before. Well, Catherine, because of her experience with the big cats, she decided that she knew exactly what had happened, that there had been a bond with a caretaker of the cat, and that when that caretaker was no longer in that animal's environment, the bond had been so strong that the animal was just feeling so alone, it wanted to die. And because it was young, she said this is almost like a bond between a cat and its mother. So she watched, she observed, and this man got the cat to eat, and it was the most life-transforming experience he had ever had. And she said, we're going to need you to stay with this animal. And he said, I'll be glad to. I never, ever have had anything like this happen to me before. So as it turned out, the animal started getting better. And Catherine, because of her talents at working with the cheetahs, she was able to take the cat back to her home in Ohio, and the animal had the whole family room. Well, I'll never forget being with this cheetah and actually being down on the floor with it, and I have some photos regarding this, and that cat smacked me with its tail. It was just wagging its tail and bong. Never knew a cat's tail could hurt as much as that did. And then I had the privilege of watching this animal being exercised on Catherine's property, and that was an experience as well. Cheetahs don't have a tremendous amount of stamina, but they're amazing animals, and they are just beautiful, beautiful creatures. And as long as I live, I will never forget sitting down on that floor and literally petting this cat, and it's just purring like a house cat would with the attention. Very intelligent, very alert, very aware creature. And it was a lifetime experience that I, like the gentleman that encountered this cat when it was very young, had. I mean, you just never forget things like this. This animal was brought back into full health because of Catherine's attention. She understands the animals very well. The reason I'm sharing that with you is because I have in front of me an article about a woman by the name of Lori Marker, and she lives in Nambia, and she is working very hard, just like Catherine did, to save cheetahs. And she used to be a wood chipper, and she has worked for 37 years to be able to save this phenomenal animal. And, of course, we know how fast they go. They can run up to 70 miles an hour. But they have been unable to hunt wild game because of the development of human population and the changes that have been occurring because of that, and also the changes in their own natural environment. There was a particular bush. Actually, it was a prickly thorn bush that becomes very, very thick. They didn't used to be in the area, but it was growing with a feverish level of development. And when the cheetahs would try to run through the bushes, they actually became blinded because of them. So now, because of Lori, they are cutting these bushes down, but nothing's going to waste. They chip them up, chop it up real fine, and it's turned into eco blocks. And this is now sold as fuel in South Africa and Europe. And now what's happening, the cheetahs are moving back into the area as well as leopards. Both of these big cats were affected. Now, Lori worked in Oregon in the 70s. She worked at a wildlife refuge, raising a tiger and a cheetah from birth. And they were with her, if you can believe it, in her mother's guest bedroom. Well, if Catherine could have them in the family room, who cares where else they go? And she would take them on tours of schools in Northern California. And in 1991, she decided she was going to get involved in Namibia a year after creating the Cheetah Conservation Fund. She said, "It is absolutely a passion of my life." And Greg Hudson, who is the executive director of the Dallas Zoo in Texas, he is a former board member of her organization, and he said, "She's just enamored of these animals, and I can understand why." Lori Marker says that these animals are just phenomenal, very smart, and they're part of the health of the ecosystem. She said, "If you ever had a chance to know a cheetah, you'd be involved with them as much as I am." There are many good people in our world today that are trying to make a difference, trying to understand the importance of humans living in balance with animals. And last night I was watching a program regarding wolves. These are wolves that have been released into the state of Oregon. Actually, wolves do a great deal to balance an environment, but farmers and ranchers have concerns, that being that the animals, the wolves, are going to kill what they have as their life income, and that is the animals that they have on their property. And this is an age-old situation. What I found so fascinating in this program last night that was on public television is that in Yellowstone, there were two men that had been very much interested in trees. Nothing to do with wolves, but just trees. And there is a grouping of trees in Yellowstone that has been disappearing at a very, very rapid rate. When they checked the historical records and they saw the photos of all of these trees and the lushness, they were aspens, I believe, and they said, "What in the world could possibly be causing this?" It wasn't a bug. It wasn't a fungus. Couldn't figure it out. When the wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone, in their research, they found the aspens started coming back. The reason that these trees had been disappearing was because without the predator, the wolf, the elk stayed in areas where these trees grew, and they were cause for the demise of the trees. When the wolves were brought back into the environment, to their amazement, they discovered not only did the trees come back because the elk were forced to move instead of staying in just one location, they found the beavers came back too, because the trees coming back gave a particular environment to the water flows, and the beavers came back doing activities that they hadn't done for generations. We really do not have a complete understanding of the intricate involvement that all forms of life play in our world. And I think that it's so important to keep our minds and attitudes open. Fears of the past may have a basis, but we need to realize that in today's world, this planet is being shared by all of us, and to learn how to deal with it in a way that is going to serve both those critters that were here before us and those that are living with us at this time, and ourselves in the best way possible. To do that, we have to be willing to learn new ways of responding and thinking about the challenges that we face. It's an interesting life we lead, and I don't know that those challenges will ever totally go away. And isn't that a wonderful thing? It gives us something to do. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to be taking a break for just a moment. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. We're going to be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley framed by high mountains rich in the brown red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com. That 800 number again, 872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna, and I know you just heard the last ad about my, you know, my children's book and the 800 number. I do want to let you know that there is going to be a change. That 800 number is going to be discontinued as of the 15th of June. So you can call me at my office directly at 253-582-5604. Yesterday, I was sharing information with you regarding Operation, or the Hope Coalition American, excuse me. It is called Operation Hope. You can look it up on the internet. And I wanted to finish giving the information that I was going to share, and this is about FEMA. The reason being is that you may know of someone that really is in desperate need of help. Today we were watching information about the tragedies in Missouri and so many other places in the United States, and the tornado season, hurricane season, season for rains. I mean, we're getting weird weather up here in the Pacific Northwest. Just as the show was starting, we were having hail come down. It looked like we were going to have everything stark white. It then went into rain, and then it just stopped all of a sudden. We are getting some very intense storms here in the Pacific Northwest, and we're not alone, but fortunately, we haven't had the severity that they have had in the Midwest and in the southern area of the United States. But I did want to share this information because I feel that it's so important. We heard that FEMA may have a problem with funds. Congress is looking at being able to delegate more funds because the disasters are just absolutely phenomenal. Now, Operation Hope and FEMA work together to enhance financial counseling to those people that are disaster survivors. And yesterday, I told you about Hope Coalition America, and what they offer is pre-disaster preparedness seminars, emergency budget counseling, emergency credit management, assistance with deferring mortgage payments, assistance communicating with your creditors, referrals to government and private agencies, assistance with obtaining copies of destroyed financial documents, and insurance claims assistance. So you have all of this. They have a mortgage hope crisis hotline. So that's some information that I feel is worth sharing. But also I wanted to bring out the information, and this was sent to me by someone that actually is working with FEMA and just flew out yesterday. They had to be out there to start work to assist people. The Operation Hope and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Federal Emergency Management Agency, which we know as FEMA, have renewed a memorandum of agreement to strengthen and expand the financial counseling resources available to help individuals and families prepare for disasters, and to recover in the shortest possible time. And FEMA is only a part of our nation's emergency management team. And they felt by partnering with Operation Hope that they would be able to assist disaster survivors with financial counseling much more effectively and efficiently. And they want them to get back, people to get back on their financial feet and feeling like they can have charge over their life as quickly as possible. And they will do so much in the way of providing workshops, but they also create a framework for cooperation between these two organizations related to disaster training, exercise opportunities, and they partner in public awareness efforts as the development of publications need to be done, manuals, seminars, and brochures. It also is, they believe, leveraging the resourcing strengths of the federal government, and all of this is worked together to assist others. So there are many voluntary organizations like the Red Cross and others that are very proactive in assisting those that need help. So all of this is available to people. Please, if you know of anyone that needs help, have them check out Operation Hope and also the information about FEMA. And I'm looking here to see exactly. I just think you could go to Operation Hope or Hope Coalition America, either one, and I think you could find out the information that you need. I think it's so important, and so many of these people, you know, life goes on, and what are you going to do? You just absolutely are at a loss, and I just think that is very, very tough to experience. In having Joe on today, I think that a quote by H.W. Dresser is worth mentioning, because I think that when we as adults are able to set a standard and we are able to live that standard, that becomes very special to the young ones whose lives we have an association with. This is what H.W. Dresser said. He said, "Be true to the best you know. This is your high ideal. If you do your best, you cannot do more. Do your best every day, and your life will gradually expand into satisfying fullness. Cultivate the habit of doing one thing at a time with quiet deliberateness. Always allow yourself a sufficient margin of time in which to do your work well. Frequently, examine your working methods to discover and eliminate unnecessary tension. Aim at poise, repose, and self-control. The relaxed worker accomplishes most." I think that is good wisdom for any of us to be aware of. Donna Sebo here. If you want to give me a buzz, the number is 888-815-9756. I also wanted to share a story with you about thoughtful actions on the part of people. We can, at any given moment, decide to do something nice for someone, not because we're supposed to, but because it's just what we want to do. And it seems like it's the right thing to do. And there was a woman by the name of Roberta. She was in her dentist's office. She had an emergency, and she really had to get in to see the dentist right away. But her babysitter wasn't available to take care of her four-year-old son. If you've ever had four-year-olds around you, they don't sit still. They're always on the go. They're always wanting to do something. Well, they were sitting in the waiting room, and of course, he's a typical little boy. He gets restless. He wants to move. And she's just thinking, while her mouth is in excruciating pain, oh, my goodness, if he is this bored now, how am I going to get through this appointment? What am I going to do? So she was really concerned. And when her little boy started showing his restlessness, she said to the receptionist, "Maybe I should cancel this appointment and reschedule when I can get my babysitter." She heard a voice behind her say, "I'd be happy to watch your son for you while you're with the dentist." She turns around and finds the woman that made the comment is sitting in the waiting room, and she just was stunned. And the receptionist said to her, "I'll be happy to help her. Don't worry about it. You go in. You really need to see the dentist. Let's take care of this, and we'll take care of your boy." She was stunned. This was something she did not expect. Do you know, after she finished with the dentist, she went back into the waiting room, and she said her son and this stranger were having a great time playing a game. She said, I felt better. The pain in my mouth was gone, and my son was just really, really happy. She said, I owe 1,000 smiles to the woman who was kind enough to help us. This is Donna Seabold. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Take this day. Give it the best that you've got. You won't regret it. Talk with you on Monday. Have a fabulous holiday weekend. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Seabold Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Seabold Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.